Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Seb Larson, and today we're joined by Professor Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin to discuss his book, Impossible Presidency, published by Basic Books in 2017. Suri examined the long history of the U.S. presidency to show how the office has changed over time, using several case studies with well-known presidents to illustrate ways that the office has evolved that make it increasingly difficult to function effectively. As the expectations around the president have grown, their inability to work has been hampered by limitations of the office, the constant demands on their attention, and the fear of overreacting to a situation making it worse. Dr. Suri concludes by considering how the office might evolve to overcome these limitations.
Dr. Suri, welcome to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you went to school, and how you came to write this particular book.
Sure. I grew up in New York City. I'm the child of immigrants, actually, from India and from Russia. And I went to public school in New York City, and I always had a love of history. Ironically enough, I went to public science and math school, Stuyvesant High School in New York City. And history was not something emphasized there a lot, but somehow I kept my love of history. And really, when I got to college, when I went to Stanford, I was exposed to historical scholarship. And one of the things I learned immediately was that history helps us to understand the development, not just of people, of biographies, but also of institutions. And that sometimes doing the biography of an institution can be as interesting as the biography of a person. And a lot of my work as a historian since then has been really trying to understand how different institutions in American society have developed. I came to believe, after doing a number of other projects, that although many people, scholars and non-scholars, write about presidents and the presidency, the office, the institution, the nature of what it means to be president, irrespective of one's personality and ideology, that has been insufficiently studied and insufficiently thought about. And major changes have occurred historically over time in what it means to be president. But those changes are often elided by the language we use that makes things sound the same. And so my historical interest in the development of institutions came together with my interest in the presidency, and that's sort of what got me to where I am now.
And just briefly for the listener, can you tell us some of the other works you've published?
Sure. So my PhD dissertation and first book was on the 1960s and early 70s, and it's called Power and Protest, that book, and it examines why we saw protest movements in so many societies, U.S., Europe, and Asia during the 1960s and 70s, from civil rights to new left activism to various other things. And it looks to explain the rise of détente and the ways in which those protest movements changed policy and politics within societies. My next book that I did was an intellectual and an international biography of Henry Kissinger, looking in particular at his early life and the influence of his Jewish background and his experience during the Holocaust, and the ways I argued that his experience watching the collapse of Weimar democracy led to his profound, I think, almost sometimes reckless disregard for democracy in later years when he was in a policymaking position. And then I did a book on American nation building, looking at how Americans have thought about nation building. That's called Liberty's Surest Guardian. And I've done a number of other projects, but this is the fourth really sort of big book that I've done, on the one on the presidency. And as with all authors, the book you've written most recently is the one you're simultaneously most excited about, but also the one you have the most trepidations about too, because it's the one you're still getting feedback on.
Right. And you haven't exactly tackled a small topic with this particular book, Impossible Presidency. So briefly, let's just start. What's the book about?
So the book is a biography of the institution of the presidency. So the idea is really to show how the institution has evolved, I guess, over time. And the point of departure for the book is that the founding fathers, when they created this institution, they weren't even sure what they were doing. I often say in talks about the book, if someone tells you they understand the original intent of the presidency, they're lying to you, because there was no original intent. The founding fathers had many, many different views, many uncertainties. They were not in agreement. And Article 2 of the Constitution is really actually an abstract, vague compromise among many points of view. So the book really tries to look at how the office, which began with uncertainty and began very small with limited powers, has come to be so powerful, so world historical, and so problematic over time. And I use individuals, I look at particular presidents who I think were transformative, but I'm really using them as windows into the way the institution itself has changed and how we need to understand that history and perhaps rethink it today if we want a more effective and more appropriate presidency.
And I just have to ask, what was it like writing this book in the age of Trump?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I wrote most of the book. In fact, the book was entirely drafted before the 2016 election. Okay. I sent the final draft, well, not the final, I sent my final draft before receiving detailed feedback from my editor and outside readers. I sent that to Basic Books, my publisher, October 31st, 2016. And I will tell you and your listeners, I actually had a concluding section that was on Hillary Clinton as the next president. I had to rewrite that, obviously. It still exists somewhere on my laptop. I revised the book, obviously, in the context of the election. Most of what I had written, most of the historical section of the book, the meat of the book, 90%, not much change. But certainly the framing a little bit. But what my editor said, which is interesting, is she always thought that the book was pointing to more of a crisis in the presidency than I myself recognized. And so maybe the logic was taking me there, and I was just refusing to see it until November of 2016.
So then is the election of Trump sort of an inevitable consequence, or at least a likely consequence of the factors that you're looking at here?
Yes, I think that although there are many things that motivate voters to do what they do, and it's still somewhat unclear why 63 million people voted for Donald Trump, there is one thing that seems to unite Trump voters and still unite them, a sense that our institutions, our powerful institutions, our democratic institutions are out of touch with a lot of people. And that's one of the points I'm making in the book, that over time, the presidency has grown more and more powerful, but its power has dislodged it from its rootedness in certain values and rootedness in certain needs of our society. So we have power serving the interests of power rather than serving the interests of people and democracy. And it appears that Donald Trump is not solving this problem at all. But I think his voters were upset about this problem. I think that's what motivated them. And Trump's inability to grapple with this problem, no matter what you think of him, his inability to grapple with it shows that it's a deeper problem that one person can't fix just by virtue of believing they're going to drain the swamp, whatever that means.
Okay. Let's dive into the meat of the book. And before I go into chapters, I'm just curious, how did you research this book?
So I love doing research. I should have said this earlier. One of the things that drew me to being a historian, I think one of the things that draws most people to history as a discipline, is that we get to marinate ourselves in fun, original materials. We go to archives. We look at what people wrote. We read their mail. We read their diaries. We love if people have diaries. And I've always enjoyed that. It's almost therapeutic, I have to say. And writing this book, I had the great joy, the great fortune to marinate myself in the works and the writings of various presidents who I thought had played a transformative role in the office of the presidency.
Wonderful. So let's start at the beginning of the book then. Where do you look, where do you look to first, and how do you structure this book?
Right. So I begin at the very beginning, which is, where did the presidency come from? How did we get a presidency? What happened at the Constitutional Convention? And what I try to show, excuse me, which I just mentioned, is that the office of the presidency comes out of a very unique problem that the founding fathers have. As everyone knows, they were against kings. I love Thomas Paine on this, by the way. Thomas Paine's view is that, he writes this in Common Sense, the child of a baker, he says, it's no more likely to be a fool than the child of a king, and the child of the baker is likely to be someone I would like more. So I've always said to people that the foundation of democracy in the American cadence is an opposition or a skepticism toward nepotism. They don't want kings, the founders, but they recognize that American society is by definition deeply divided. The Catholics in Maryland refuse to even believe that the high Protestants in Massachusetts have any claim on Christianity. And the Quakers think they're all out of their minds, the Quakers in Pennsylvania. We are more deeply divided as a society in the 18th century than we are today. People in Georgia can't even understand what people in Massachusetts are saying. Maybe it's still true. I don't know. So the founders recognize that we can't have a king, but we must have someone who stands above party, someone who stands above region, someone who stands above what James Madison calls faction, someone who can unite the country, someone who can speak for the country as a whole. That had traditionally been what kings had done. If we're not going to have a hereditary figure, we have to find some figure who we choose for this office. So they invent this notion of an executive. It's interesting. I show this in the book. The word executive was not used as a noun until this time. It was only an adjective. You had executive functions. But the notion of an executive, a secular figure who was chosen by the people and would serve the interests of the broader public and do that out of merit and virtue coming from the people, to lead the people themselves. That's the office they're trying to create. And that's what this presidency is supposed to be. And that's why we have all these odd features to it, that the president's supposed to be selected by the people, but not really directly selected, because he's not supposed to be their favorite guy. He's supposed to be the person who actually can bring them together. There's supposed to be some basis in each of the states of the presidency, but it's not a creature of the states. And the founders, most of them, believe that presidents shouldn't be part of parties. So that's where this office comes from. They don't really know how it's going to work. Most of the founders believed that a Congress would end up choosing the president because they couldn't imagine that any one figure would get enough electoral votes. They figured the largest states would each nominate a favorite son, as they were called, that the Electoral College would be divided. And as we know, if you have four people with electoral votes, it goes to the Congress to choose. That's only happened 3 times in our history, but they actually expected it to happen more often. So the office evolves out of an urge to have this new kind of executive, and we figure it out as we go. This is a really big point. The presidency is not made by the Constitution. It's made by our historical evolution as a society.
And expectations and precedent, which is why I think Washington comes across as so significant in this narrative. Give us a little bit more about Washington.
Sure. Washington, to me, remains one of the most fascinating figures, and everyone knows a little bit about him, but few people know enough about George Washington. He had a sense that this office really had to unite the country. He had a deep sense of this because, as the leader of American revolutionary forces, he saw how divided and dysfunctional the Continental Congress was. I like to tell people that if there's anyone who understood and would understand the dysfunctionalism of American Congress today, it would be George Washington, because he dealt with this. He dealt with an even more dysfunctional Congress than the Continental Congress. No state wanted to pay their dues to the revolution. They didn't want to put up their soldiers. Everyone was looking out for their own provincial interests. You had gerrymandered districts. You had all these issues. So he believed deeply that this had to be the case. And he didn't fall into this role. He crafted himself as that figure, created an image of himself that way. And when he was in office, he was very self-conscious about seeing the office not as a policymaking office, but as a uniting office for the country, truly being a father figure in his own eyes and the eyes of many of his people. And then also creating precedents. He had a very clear sense that what he was doing was actually more important for the precedent it created than for what it did in the short run. And his ability to think in those terms, I think, shows he had a historical sensibility that very few figures have. He creates the presidency because he creates some of the early rituals, and he creates two important traditions which carry forward. One is that the president is to speak for and represent all Americans, not just those Americans who voted for him, also those Americans who did not vote for him. And two, that the president is to invest the resources of the federal government in projects that serve the nation as a whole. And that's, of course, why he adopts Hamilton's economic plan. It's why he calls for a university system in the United States. He's looking to what he calls infrastructures of nationhood, things that will benefit the country as a whole.
So then the next figure that we jump to, Washington sets these precedents. The next president you discuss is Jackson. Yes. Jackson is a sea change. What is the change?
Well, Washington believed that the presidency should be an office that brings together the best people and speaks from the people, but in a sense speaks out of the best of their virtues. And Jackson really saw the office more as needing to reach out to those who had been left out, particularly those on the frontier. So Jackson is part of a generation of Americans who are immigrants who move west in search of land, move to Tennessee and places like that. And before Jackson, all of the prior presidents are from Virginia or Massachusetts, and they do represent a kind of high society United States. And Jackson wants to connect the presidency to ordinary people more. That's why we often call him a populist, though that term is often misused. It's also why he wants the office to be more powerful. He wants the office to help people, help those who have been left out, particularly on the frontier, and help them to eliminate barriers to their prosperity on the frontier. And the biggest barrier to the prosperity of frontier settlers in Jackson's time are Native Americans, Indians. And this is why he becomes close to a genocidal president in his use of federal power, often against the rulings of the Supreme Court, to move Indians off the land and serve the interests, what he sees as the broader, deeper interests of settlers in the West. At the same time, though, he is an arch advocate of union and has a deep falling out. And you can see this is the long origins of the Civil War, with people like John C. Calhoun and others who are arguing that the presidency should be less powerful and the states should have more control over decisions. Jackson's view is the president needs to be more powerful, bring the country together, and help use his power to serve the interests of those outside of the traditionally powerful areas of the country. So he's a union advocate, but an advocate for Western frontier interests. And he turns the presidency into this rougher, more frontier institution that we come to resent, that we come to recognize as a more active presidency thereafter.
You know, it's interesting. You just mentioned in discussing Washington and the expectations of the founders that they believed that most elections for the presidency would be resolved in the House of Representatives. Jackson loses an election in 1824 on that very system, and he thereafter seems to have a very combative relationship with the legislature. Does this sort of signal a new role with the executive branch in terms of the legislative branch going forward?
Yes, and it's a great point and something I talk about in my chapter. I mean, Jackson comes to believe that he represents the people more than members of Congress do. Washington believed that he represented the people in a different way, but he did not believe Congress was unrepresentative. Jackson argues that Congress, under the leadership of Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and these titans, these figures who we revere, who we sometimes say we wish we'd have back in Congress today, that these figures are representing provincial elites. They're not representing the country as a whole, and that he's the only figure that does that. And this is his argument for, as you say, taking on and trying at times to undermine Congress. This is his argument for also critiquing the Supreme Court. He says he has the right to read the law his way because he speaks for the people. And this emphasis upon what he will call popular sovereignty is a way of strengthening the presidency, but it's also, as you say, a way of disempowering those institutions he believes are less representative in serving other, what he believes are corrupt interests, like the corrupt interests he believes initially denied him the presidency when he ran against John Quincy Adams in 1824.
So that's Jackson. Where does Lincoln fit into this?
Well, my gosh. Abraham Lincoln, and this is another reason I love being a historian. Abraham Lincoln is one of those figures you can never read enough of. I really believe that. The more you read, the more you revere, the more you see in this man. He had 2 years of education. I'm pretty sure everyone listening to this has had more education than Abraham Lincoln. But yet he's not only one of the great writers as a president, he's one of the great writers in American history, full stop. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had to put together your list of top 5 or 10, he'd be in it, along with Mark Twain and Nathaniel Hawthorne and Hemingway and others. He's up there. I mean, he's Faulkner. He's up there with them. And what he does, Lincoln, is he fuses in many ways the best of Washington and the best of Jackson. And there's probably more Jackson than Washington, actually, in Lincoln. He grows up in a border state in Kentucky, and he grows up as a poor white boy without much family support. He doesn't own land. He doesn't own slaves. And he becomes committed very early on to this thing called capitalism, this notion that creating a market society where people are actually compensated for their work and incentivized to do work will benefit people like him, who's able-bodied and bright, but not privileged and not having access to capital of his own, that the capital should flow to the work rather than the capital flowing to family or inheritance or things of that sort. And he uses the English language to not simply advocate for that position, but to redefine American identity along those lines. That's what the Gettysburg Address is about. That's what the Second Inaugural is about. That's what his Cooper Union Address, when he says Bill coming out as a candidate in New York City, is all about. Lincoln's argument is that the presidency must create opportunity. This is what the Republican Party is about: free labor, free soil, free men. And the presidency must not set policy for the country, but must create a guiding hand for the expansion of industrial capitalism, which for a poor white boy from a border state is the expansion of economic opportunity. That men like Lincoln can get educated as he couldn't, that men like Lincoln can own land as he couldn't for a long time, and that men like Lincoln can be paid for their work, as many slaves weren't, and as, quite frankly, poor whites like Lincoln weren't paid very much. That's the Republican Party: free labor, free soil, free men. And that's what Lincoln is bringing forward. During the course of the Civil War, he not only oversees in a very difficult way the defeat of the Confederacy and the slavery with the 13th Amendment, more than that, He greatly expands the role of the president as this guiding figure for industrial capitalist development. I talk about this in my chapter, and he gives beautiful language to this: the creation of a public university system. Mm-hmm. You know, there are very few things the United States does before everyone else. We like to think we do all the time. We usually don't. The one exception is a public university system. We create, with the Morrill Land Grant Act of 1862, the first true public university system, the land grant system. Lincoln also creates another Homestead Act that provides access to land for immigrants. In fact, you did not have to be a citizen to be a landowner. It's amazing. It provides ownership and a stake in society, an opportunity for Mexican and German and Irish and other immigrants in places like Oklahoma. You know, why else would anyone go to Oklahoma except to get free land, I guess. And then third, he creates the first federal subsidy system for the railroads. And that's how we get the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869, soon after his death. And we become, by that time, the largest single integrated market in the world. We still are. And if there's one thing that's the basis for our development as a world power, it's that. Our foreign policy has often been very bad, but we've just had a lot of resources, and we've had a lot of resources because we have a lot of land that's integrated into a single market in the way other resource-rich areas aren't. And that's all the vision that he has, and that's what he does as president. I argue he's a poet as president, but he's also a CEO. He's pursuing an economic plan for capitalist development. Mm-hmm. And that's what Reconstruction is in its best days. Reconstruction fails more than it succeeds. But in its best moments, Reconstruction is about trying to bring Northern-style capitalism to the South, which would provide some African-Americans with access to resources, exactly what Booker T. Washington will later talk about at Tuskegee. That's within a Republican framework. It's within the framework of providing opportunity and capitalist development. So he is the capitalist president.
So your point about industrial capitalism, I think, is interesting. You know, there's a tendency to write off every president that comes after Lincoln until about Teddy Roosevelt, which is where you pick up again, as weak. And yet, I think what you're saying here is that there's actually a much stronger presidency post-Lincoln that Lincoln helps to inaugurate. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. So after Lincoln's presidency, and then after the presidency of Andrew Johnson, the stormy presidency of Andrew Johnson, there's a concerted effort, perhaps a conspiracy, among Southern former Confederate Democrats and Northern radical Republicans to limit the power of the presidency through Congress, because members of both of those parties in Congress believe that the more moderate Republican figures who are chosen as president, people like Rutherford B. Hayes, Ulysses Grant, they believe that they're not sufficiently one or the other. They're not sufficiently radical for the radical Republicans. They're not sufficiently favorable to the Confederates for the Democrats. So Congress acts to stymie the president in ways we've seen in our own society the last decade or so. But that limits presidential power in legislation. It does not limit a lot of presidential power in other areas. Presidents move toward closer collaboration and conjunction with different business and industrial interests, seeing that as their job, seeing that as a lucrative source of resources, and seeing that as a way to leave a lasting imprint upon the country. And that's why the Gilded Age is largely known from Ulysses Grant forward as this period of corruption, this period of big business, corporate dominance. And that's the world presidents operate in. They have enormous power in that area because they are able to, through executive authority, control how land is used in the country. And land is the greatest resource the country has at the time. It's what we also have in surplus. And so the allocation of land, the allocation of access to land and access to resources, and the conjunction or collaboration between business interests and the presidency make the president, as the arch industrial capitalist leader of the country, a much more powerful figure in this period.
Interesting. And I have just one last question about Lincoln, then we should move on. You know, Washington is somebody who's so acutely aware of precedent, you know, to an almost sort of superhuman degree. I can't really think of that many other people who seem to operate, maybe de Gaulle, with an awareness of how history and society is looking at them. Do you ever get the sense that Lincoln was doing that? Because as he prosecutes the Civil War, he takes steps that put him directly into conflict with the courts, even on occasion wing members of his own party. And yet is he doing so because he feels he needs to fight the war and it's an extraordinary set of circumstances? Or is he doing so because that's his belief of what just a president should be, relatively regardless of circumstance?
It's a great question. I think Lincoln was acutely aware of precedent, but I think he thought about it differently from Washington. I think Washington believed he was creating, and I think he succeeded in this, in creating precedent, it kind of behavioral precedents. What he did would be how he was judged and how he held himself. He was a symbolic precedent creator and a behavioral precedent creator. Lincoln really relied on language. Lincoln was living through such a difficult period of challenges, the Civil War, of course, at the top of the list. And he knew he had to cut corners so many times and do things that he himself said he would not have been comfortable doing in other circumstances. I love his statement about this. I quote in the book where he talks about how a surgeon would sometimes cut off a hand to save a life, but you wouldn't cut off the life to save the hand. And he thought sometimes he was cutting off hands, restrictions on habeas corpus, for example, things of that sort, that other circumstances he would have been opposed to, but in these emergency circumstances had to be done. He did not want that to be precedent. So he did not always want his behaviors to be precedent setting. He wanted his language. He wanted his explanation of what he was doing. He wanted the larger rationale, the larger purpose. And that's what he succeeded in doing, in providing us the words we still use. How often do you hear people say it's the job of a leader to bring out the better angels in our nature, or to find the mystic chords of memory that connect our country, or define democracy as government of the people, by the people, for the people? He didn't really rule that way. His administration was really not government of the people, by the people, for the people. But that's what the war was about. And so he was creating precedent in the language and narrative that we still continue to rely on to define who we are.
Wonderful. And yeah, I see what you mean about Lincoln being so tremendously fun to study, because Lincoln's language is so tremendously fun to live inside of.
Absolutely. And it's everlasting
in a certain way. Yeah, it's still remarkably accessible in a way that most of his peers, you bring up in the book, Jefferson Davis, was better educated and yet a worse public speaker. I can't think of a single time in my life that somebody's quoted Jeff Davis at.
Right, right.
You know, just that doesn't happen.
Right, and think about the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., which is my favorite memorial, that beautiful Daniel Chester French statue, and having the Gettysburg Address on one wall and the second inaugural. First of all, they're short enough to fit on a wall. and people from all around the world come and read them and are moved by these. And there are very few politicians who can do that.
Mm-hmm. So now we move on to what might be, at least until relatively recently, one of the greatest outsized personalities in American political history, Teddy Roosevelt. You know, everybody's favorite, every political cartoonist's favorite president to draw, even long after he's dead, right?
Yes.
What does Teddy do to the presidency?
Well, so Teddy, and this is another theme of mine, he studied his predecessors, just as Lincoln studied Jackson and Washington. Teddy Roosevelt, sees himself as a disciple of Abraham Lincoln. He's really the next great Republican president after Abraham Lincoln. And Theodore Roosevelt, in part, wants to do what Abraham Lincoln did for the continent. He wants to do for the hemisphere and perhaps for the world. He wants to be a leader of a new moment of industrial capitalism, which he also defines as part of democracy for the hemisphere and the world. And that's one of the reasons he gets so involved in foreign affairs. Think about the Panama Canal as the extension of Lincoln's railroad to Central America, providing a passageway for products and people from one coast to the other without having to go all the way around South America. And Theodore Roosevelt also believes that part of being this leader of an industrial capitalist economy means you have to take a firmer role as the CEO in creating institutions that bring out the best in the country, make it the most productive it can be, but also improve the quality of life in the country. So he is the first progressive president in that he surrounds himself with all of these progressive reformers, people who are committed to being more rational, using government resources in more rational ways, in more enlightened ways, to make government serve the people, serve the economy, and serve the world better. He begins this actually long before he's president, working on civil service reform. He's part of the Civil Service Commission in the late 19th century that's created to reform the civil service. When he begins that work, a very large proportion of people working in the civil service are still illiterate. In fact, they create the first test. So you're appointed to a job in the post office, not because your friend is politically connected, but because you can actually do the job, right? And so this emphasis on rationality. And he surrounds himself as president with many figures like Jacob Riis, who had written about poverty, how the other half lives, Jane Addams, a settlement house movement, Frederick Law Olmsted, park design and urban architecture and urban planning, and really invests his energy in pushing for these reforms to be implemented that will make the United States a more enlightened, progressive, high quality of life place that will also be more powerful on the world stage. So in that sense, he is our first modern president. He's the one who really resonates with a lot of the language and a lot of the sort of boisterous and bullying behavior that we come to accept and sometimes even expect in presidents.
And what about, how does TR think globally? How does he think about the rest of the world?
Yeah, so he sees the United States as a rising power by virtue of its enlightenment, by virtue of its democracy, by virtue of its resources. And he wants the United States to be able to flex its muscles overseas. And he's worried that we're going to be locked out of areas like Asia that are very important to us, or that we're going to have a rising number of enemies on our shores. Here he's worried about the collapse of Spanish power in Cuba and elsewhere and the rise of both German and British activities in that region. So he wants the United States to be more stronger to assert itself. We should be enlightened and muscled at the same time. He wants the United States to be respected. And he wants the United States not to go to war all the time, though he's happy to go to war sometimes, but to be a mediator. He believes in a world of great powers, in a world of balance of power politics, and he believes in diplomacy. And there's so many things we can associate with all those things. So he does support military activity for the United States to prohibit Spanish continuance in Cuba and the Philippines and replace them with American authority rather than British or German authority. He helps to negotiate a settlement to the Russo-Japanese War, for which he receives a Nobel Peace Prize. He builds and flaunts the Great White Fleet, this American Navy. He'd come out of the Navy, he'd written about the Navy, he had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The Great White Fleet, not mistakenly named the Great White Fleet, it sails around the world. It's still inferior to the British or German navies, but he's showing that we've come of age. Theodore Roosevelt didn't seek to rule the world. He didn't seek to fight wars everywhere. He sought for the United States to be one of the great powers in the world and for us to use that status to have more and more influence in the capitalist and humanitarian and democratic development of the world as he saw it. He believed this was part of the spread of civilization, and that's the phrase he used quite often, civilization.
And does that take with the successors? Because especially in terms of foreign policy, this is starting to move pretty far away from Washington's farewell address, at least in the minds of many Americans.
Yes.
But there's a shift that you detect there after Roosevelt, the first Roosevelt.
Yes, yes, yes. I think I'm one of many historians to write about the Roosevelt presidency as a sea change, as you say, in America's presence in the world. And again, talking about the biography of institutions, once you build it, it's hard to unbuild it, right? Once you make yourself part of a larger world system, it's hard to pull yourself out of it and remain separate from it. But TR also continues to make the argument that the United States is going to do things differently from the rest of the world. So you get this fusion of sometime imperial-like behaviors by the United States, but a deep anti-imperialism within the way we think about our imperial behaviors. And the great historian William Appleman Williams, decades ago, referred to this as American imperial anti-imperialism. And there is something to that. And you can, I don't want us to get, to run ahead too fast, but you can see that in a lot of what happened. You can see that in Iraq, where we show up and we're acting in TR fashion, right, as a big power trying to eliminate a regime that we argue is standing in the way of appropriate modern development. But at the same time, we're not going to act like a colonial power. We're not going to invest in major transformations. We're going to expect that's going to naturally come out of the ground. So we're imperial, anti-imperial, rather than just one or the other.
Yeah. Williams hit upon a really useful framework there, I think. So moving next to TR's cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, everybody likes to talk about how much the New Deal changed expectations around American government. Where do you see that change going on here?
Well, I call Franklin Roosevelt in my chapter the great national healer. I think he's the greatest president we've ever had. I think Lincoln's the most fascinating figure. I think Washington is the absolute necessary one. We wouldn't have gotten off the ground without him. He's the true founder. But Franklin Roosevelt is the great president, and this is a part of the argument of the book. He's the zenith of the presidency, and it's from the zenith that we decline very fast, in part because we've reached this height. It's almost as if we get to this extraordinary height. We're at the top of Everest, and the air is too thin. And so we start to fall of our own weight. thereafter. What does the New Deal do? Most fundamental of all, it connects this powerful institution that, as we've talked about, does so much more for economic development, for military security, and it connects it to ordinary people. It's a different presidency and it's a different world. Before Franklin Roosevelt, most Americans did not think the president was an important part of their lives. During Roosevelt's presidency, he became an important part of everyone's life, even those who didn't like him. This shows up overwhelmingly in the oral histories for the period. Roosevelt came into people's homes, and part of it's the radio. Part of it is this man's incredible ability to empathize with people so different from himself. And this is what I learned from Franklin Roosevelt. Leadership, the most important quality is empathy. Can you convince people who are different from you that you, in Bill Clinton's terms, feel their pain? Can you feel other people's pain? People don't actually want you to tell them what to do or give them the answers. They want to feel validated, and then they're willing to work with you. Leadership is more coaching than it is dictating. And Roosevelt is the master at that. He uses the office to surround himself with people who will help him understand the suffering of others. He uses his language to articulate authentically that he understands. And then he pursues what he calls bold experimentation. Or in another phrase, he says he throws jelly at the wall to try every way he can to help limit the suffering, to heal the suffering of others. He's the medicine man. And it's terribly inefficient. And it causes debt, and more programs fail than succeed. But it's this process and the courage behind this that gets us to some of our most successful programs in turning our country around and preparing ourselves for war. Take something like the Civilian Conservation Corps. Millions of Americans, young Americans between 18 and 30, end up going and living in camps and building pathways in national parks, planting trees. Not only does it get them off the streets, not only does it give them a sense of public service, it gives them belonging. It gives them pride. It gives them lessons in cooperation. And you then read these oral histories of these same men serving in World War II. The CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, was their preparation.
Mm-hmm. It's telling that, I mean, even today, a lot of states actually still have CCC programs. I know
yes.
Alaska does off the top of my head. And even in Roosevelt's presidency, it was actually something that had genuine bipartisan support. Even other people who opposed other parts of the New Deal were pretty okay with the CCC.
That's right. But the other interesting thing is this was not an idea that Franklin Roosevelt concocted himself. It was not something he had ever participated in himself. It came to him from his willingness to listen to others, bring ideas around him. And in this sense, he's like Theodore Roosevelt, invest his office in these new ideas.
And what does he do globally?
Well, this system, this New Deal system, as we've just described it, he makes the case that that's the solution to fascism and communism, that communism and fascism are diseases of Lincoln's capitalism run amok, that capitalism by its nature, this is Joseph Schumpeter's argument, right? It's creative destruction, that it creates a lot, but it destroys a lot. And they're always losers. I'm a capitalist myself, but I always remind students, every capitalist system has made some people richer and some people poorer. There's no capitalist system that ever has made everyone richer. And those who are left behind are often maimed and harmed, deeply harmed by this system. He argues, Roosevelt, as many others did at the time, that fascism and communism play to those damaged bodies and damaged souls, or the fear of that damage. And they promise people that they don't have to make the hard choices and that everyone will be all right and that the dictator will decide for them or the party will decide for them. Roosevelt argues that the United States, to protect democracy, to protect its system, it has to invest in underlying New Deal reforms overseas. That's not the same as the United States taking over other countries, but it's about creating institutions. We're back to institutions here. Institutions that do some of this work. And Roosevelt is the great international institution builder. The United Nations comes out of Roosevelt. World Bank, IMF, what soon becomes the GATT system, of World Trade and the World Trade Organization, Declaration of Human Rights. It's all there in the Atlantic Charter and various other elements of Roosevelt's activities, not creating American dominance per se, but creating a new deal for the world, an alternative to the rough and tumble capitalist systems that he believed were also producing fascism and communism.
Now, with these five case studies, I was curious reading the book. Do you get any sense that the expectations of the public or in popular culture change around the presidency with sort of after these exemplary sort of case studies come along? You know, once yes. Roosevelt comes along, well, the second Roosevelt, then everybody expects a much more activist government and executive branch.
That's exactly right. In some ways, the presidency for its first 150 years becomes the victim of its own successes, because people expect it to accomplish all the things it's accomplished, but they're angry about the costs and things they don't like. So they want the outcome without the sweat equity. and this is particularly true for the New Deal. Anyone who's looked at the New Deal, who studied it, generally sees a lot of success, but also sees a lot of failure. And every failure is wasted money, right? So what people want is they want all the successes without the failures, right? Like the students of mine who want A's, you know, and believe you can write an A paper. I always say, you can't write an A paper. You've got to write a paper that has to be heavily edited, and you better edit it before you give it to me if you want an A, right? It's the same thing here. And this is why, this is perhaps a side issue, but I'll say it anyway. This is why this sort of cult of efficiency is so damaging. You know, the real work of politics is not efficient. It's inefficient. That's not a justification for waste, but it's an art, and it's about getting ahead by trying lots of different things. We succeed so well in so many areas that we forget about all the failures that were necessary along the line. And when we see those failures again, we don't invest in them because we forget what it really takes.
Hmm. So what happens after Franklin Roosevelt then? What do his successors have to contend with?
Well, I think Roosevelt can just barely hold it all together. By early 1945, before his death, he really is president of the world. We're the only ones left standing. The Soviet Union wins the war as much as we do, if not even more. But they've lost almost their entire industrial capacity, as well as 30 million citizens. We've lost 500,000. That's a lot. But it's nowhere near the loss of the Soviet Union. And our other competitors, Germany, France, Japan, they're completely devastated. I mean, truly devastated in every way. So Roosevelt is the only person with a sustainable vision. He's the only person with resources, really. And he's taken on now all of these commitments. And therein lies the problem. It's not simply that the expectations of the president at home are so much greater. They're so much greater overseas. And every president after Roosevelt until the current one tries to be Roosevelt. Many of them are equally talented, but they fail because they're taking on too much. And I want to be clear about this because it's been sometimes misunderstood in some reviews of the book. You know, I'm not arguing for smaller government or bigger government. I'm arguing for government aligning its resources with its purposes better. And that involves choosing priorities, and that involves allocating resources to them. The problem presidents will have after Roosevelt is that the number of priorities will multiply, the number of pressures will multiply, and they will spread themselves too thin. That's not a problem of small government or big government. That's a problem of absent focus. And I try to show this in the book. Roosevelt, as busy as he is, as many things as he's doing, his calendar, and I love calendars of presidents. I reprint some in the book. You can see in his calendar, he's able to cluster the issues. He's able to bring the issues together and focus on priorities and put his time behind his priorities. That is lost with presidents thereafter, who quite frankly are managing a world and managing a complex country and never get the time to do the thinking, the leadership work, and the creativity that's necessary for effective leadership thereafter.
That is interesting to think about. You know, one of the things that I was so struck by was the extent to which that president of the world phenomenon that you mentioned, Franklin Roosevelt, once other presidents have to grapple with that, how efficient can they really be in office? And was there ever a way that we could have avoided that?
Yes. Yes. I think one of the real missed opportunities in the post-war period is to be more careful about defining where our interests are in the world and where they are not. Mm-hmm. One of the big mistakes we make is to come to believe, particularly after the Korean War, because the Korean War, I think, is the turning point in the Cold War. We really come to believe that communism anywhere is something we need to stop at all costs. And that overstretch, that sort of ridiculous domino theory. I mean, you think about this idea that we had a theory about dominoes to explain the world. Really? We couldn't do better than that? That kind of overstretch, as Paul Kennedy calls it, that makes it very difficult for us to make the hard choices and invest where we need to. Thankfully, after World War II, we're able to make some of those investments, but it becomes harder and harder. And by the 1970s, I mean, my undergraduates find it hard to understand, not only Vietnam. I mean, we're fighting in Angola. All of a sudden, Angola has become this important area with the United States, the Cubans, the Russians, the Chinese. We're all fighting in Angola. And you wonder, what are we fighting over here? And there's, maybe we've forgotten, but because the bad guys are there, we've got to be there too. Mm-hmm. So that kind of what I would say is exactly the problem here. A powerful presidency becoming a log rolling institution, trying to please as many people as possible rather than serving the national interest. That becomes the problem. And sometimes government is too small, and that's what's creating this, right? Because we don't have enough investment in the things we really care about, so we try to do too many other small things rather than the few big things.
And why is it that we can't walk back after the Cold War ends? I mean, everybody can agree that Americans become just obsessed with communism, and they always sort of had been, but it gets much worse after 1945. But in theory, that's not a problem after 1989. So why is it that we're still seeing the same behavior?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think there are two reasons why. One is about legacies. We've inherited these commitments, and it's very hard to undo commitments. For another project I worked on with some other scholars, we tried to find evidence of times when the United States had inherited a commitment and said that it was no longer going to fulfill it. And it's very rare we do that. We just keep adding commitments on. It's like departments in a university. You never close one. You just keep adding more, right?
Yeah.
It's a new idea. Okay, we'll add a new department, which usually is a good idea, but maybe you should think about reforming some of the old ones, right? We become additive rather than synthesizing in these areas. And after the Cold War, there's a tendency to do that in part, and this is the second reason, because we don't know what we're about anymore. Our organizing principle in the international system has really gone away. We don't have a communist adversary. And if you don't know what you're about, the easiest thing to do is to just try to do everything better. And so I think our policy, the way to understand foreign policy from 1991 to 2001 is we go around the world saying anything you can do, we can do better.
But then on the flip side of it, being too afraid of doing too much, as you point out with Clinton in Rwanda, is just like a fantastic example in this book, because especially in the wake of Somalia, he finds, okay, if he overreacts here, he's just going to open himself up to endless backlash at home.
Yes.
He you know, just seems to be caught between impossible demands at any given moment. Fitting.
Right. And so that's exactly right. And he feels he's failed where he's been involved, so he's going to try to stay uninvolved in the face of genocide and pretend genocide is not happening, even though we have an international obligation to intervene when there's genocide. This is the Genocide Convention that Ronald Reagan signed. And so he's not actually cutting back on what we do. He's trying to do it in ways that are less costly, and military intervention is too costly for him now. And so he's looking for costless ways, but he never comes out and says, you know, this is a part of the world, perhaps, where we shouldn't be involved, or a part of the world where we can't do the things we wanted to do before. He doesn't adjust expectations. He just denies that there's a problem. Right? That's the really chilling part of Rwanda, is the way he pretends it's not a problem when, of course, it is.
Mm. So you've noted an interesting paradox as you go through the book, that the expectations are on the one hand killing the job. It's making it far too difficult for any human being to do this, no matter how much energy or brilliance they can bring to the job. But then the subsequent failure just leads to more demands for somebody who can fix it, which maybe is how we got to Trump. But you could also work that backwards to Obama. How do we dig ourselves out of this hole?
Well, that's the hard question, and I'm better on diagnosing problems than offering solutions. My wife would agree on that too, by the way, about her diagnosis of me. I think, first of all, we've got to understand the problem. And we've got to understand that the problem is not only about the capabilities and personality of the person in office. That if tomorrow we had whoever someone thinks is the most ideal person, you know, the LeBron James or Kevin Durant of presidents, the Michael Jordan, you know, Babe Ruth, whatever it is, what I'm arguing is they would fall flat on their face too. There's a structural problem. There's an institutional problem going back to where we started. And it's not going to be fixed by individuals alone. Now, don't get me wrong. The individual still matters. The person driving the car matters. But the point here is that we have a problem with the engine, the way the engine has evolved over time and how the roads have changed. And the engine doesn't work on the roads we're driving on anymore, no matter who the driver is, right? A Model T is not going to win a race now, no matter if you get the best driver for it. And so we need to start thinking about doing what, in fact, we did when it was easier, when we were smaller in the first half of the book, the first 150 years. Where we adjusted and reformed our institutions. The presidency by Roosevelt's time was an institutionally different president, unimaginable from the institution George Washington inherited. Washington would not recognize Roosevelt's presidency. Mm-hmm. And yet we've remained stuck in the institutions. We've come to fetishize these institutions. And we need to have some serious thought, which we can do, about how to reform these institutions as we also look for better people to put in them to better serve the world that we're in. One point I make at the end of the book is just the volume of what presidents have to deal with should lead us to question whether one person could ever do this. And that wasn't a problem for Washington. It wasn't even a problem for Lincoln. Lincoln had a really tough job, but he still had a relatively small range of issues to deal with. Today, we have gone from being, in a sense, the founding model society for democracy to being a backwater in that we're the only country, only major democracy in the world that has a single executive. Most others, divide authority between a prime minister who comes out of the legislature, of course, but plays an executive role, and a president. That's what Germany does. That's what France does. That's what India does. Why do we think we can find this one person to do what they don't think one person can do in Germany alone, which is a much smaller country? So that's just one example of many places where I think we need to have creative thinking about our institutions and enter into institutional reform. And we go through these phases in our society. I think we're going to get into one of these. I think that's what young people want to do. Mm. Look how innovative, for good and bad, we've been in other areas. Why can't we do that in our politics?
There was one point you made that I wanted to not push back on, but I'm looking for clarification myself because I agree with it. You say that one thing that continues to bog down presidents, and it has at this point since Roosevelt, is this tendency to get wrapped up in divisive cultural issues. It just saps their strength. I mean, talk about Lilliputian. At the other end of it, we did have a president, Lyndon Johnson, who was able to confront an issue that none of his predecessors wanted to deal with. And he actually was at least able to force through part of a solution. If it didn't please everybody, in hindsight, we can all agree it did something demonstrably good. It was divisive. It made good government difficult. But how do we reconcile those two? How do we give the president space to be able to act in the common good and take a difficult stand without then letting himself get tied up into knots on potential nothing issues?
Fantastic question. And there's no doubt I make this point in the book. I think it's hard to argue against this in any way. Lyndon Johnson does more for civil rights than any president had done since Lincoln after his time. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 would not have looked anything nearly as expansive as it was if John F. Kennedy had lived. In fact, Johnson uses Kennedy's tragic death to cajole and manipulate people into supporting what is a landmark piece of legislation. Absolutely right. Basically, the end of segregation is not Brown v. Board, right? It is the 64 Act. That's actually when the University of Texas, my institution, integrated. Students can't believe this. We were a segregated institution, really, until then. It wasn't that, university presidents and restaurant owners all of a sudden decided that, now we'll let blacks in, right? It was actually the federal government forced them to do this. Mm-hmm. So we need presidents to do that sort of thing. Absolutely. That's not the kind of cultural issue I'm talking about. The problem is we've come to look to presidents to take stands on cultural issues to reaffirm our particular beliefs, mm-hmm. even when there isn't a public policy, a necessary public policy issue attached to it. And I do think abortion is a good example here. I think it's very different from what we're talking about with civil rights. People can have their own views on, you know, whether abortion should be legal or not or protected. I have my views. People can have their own views. I'm not an expert on this. But I don't think the president has anything to do with this. This is not a presidential decision. This is not within the range of the president. The president's not, by saying anything, going to make this change. The president doesn't decide this. So why bother? Why bother getting involved in that debate? That's only symbolic politics. That's only a distraction from the real work. There are controversial issues presidents need to speak on. I think, for example, reforming our healthcare system. Mm. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but our healthcare system is destroying us. It's ineffective. It eats up our GDP. It reinforces inequality. I don't know what the solution is, but that's something presidents probably should work on. And they should stop talking about abortion and start talking about that.
Very good. I feel like I could talk with you about this book for a few hours, but we do have to wrap it up. So I wanted to ask one last question. What are you working on right now?
So I'm starting, and I'm in a very early stage. I'm starting a book on America since 9/11. And what I want to look at, it follows perfectly from the last question you asked, the intersection between politics and political culture in our society. And why is it that our political culture has gone into the toilet? And what about the decisions after 9/11 that took us into the toilet? And of course, what are the ways we can come out of the toilet? And I really do think, and the Iraq War is one of these things, a set of decisions we made, not by evil people, actually, but decisions that were driven by power, driven by anger, driven by selfishness, driven by ignorance, took us down a road to where we are today. And we need to revisit those decisions in order to do better going forward. So sort of America from 9/11 to Trump.
Wonderful. I'll look forward to it. Thank you so much, Dr. Suri, for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure. This has been a wonderful interview, and I really appreciate the high quality of your questions.
Thank you so much.